Welcome everyone to the Road to Glasgow COP26 series. Delighted to be joined this morning by my colleague Luca Karadi. Say hello, Luca.
Good morning.
Good morning, Luca. And also we have a very special guest on the show today, Graham Roy, Professor Graham Roy from the Fraser Valander Institute. Hi, Graham.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning. Really pleased to have you on. So the format for today is very straightforward. We're going to have a very in-depth conversation about the Scottish economy, the road to Glasgow for COP26 in November 2021. Really keen to hear your views on where we are right now from an economic perspective and how we're going to get to COP26 feeling vaguely happy with ourselves that we're on the right track for COP26. So Grant, so let me ask Graham just to kick off. Could you just give a bit of an introduction as to how you got to where you are right now? How did you end up in the position of leading the Fraser Valander Institute?
So it's quite an interesting journey. So I started actually back in the Fraser Valander about 15 years ago when I was just finished my PhD and spent a couple of years there, and then got bored of being an academic. Being an academic, and decided I would join the government. And I spent about in total about 8.5 years in the Scottish government in a variety of different economics roles, looking at the broader Scottish economy through to all the economic analysis going around the energy at the time. And that was obviously just at the time where the government were investing heavily in supporting the growth in renewables, but also some interesting, challenging periods around oil and gas. And it also had the small event of 2014 in the middle of all of that. And then I moved over into policy and helped set up the First Minister's Policy Unit for a couple of years, and then came back to take over the Fraser Valander and to lead that. And the Fraser's, it's a really interesting organisation. It's been around this year, actually. This month it's celebrating its 45th anniversary. So it's quite unique in a Scottish context to have something that's been around for that length of time. And it's a really interesting organisation. It does a whole host of different kind of academic studies, but then also heavily policy work and engage with businesses, and lots of interesting analysis. And it's good fun. It's an interesting time to be an economist, trying to work out what on earth is going on with the world.
Absolutely, and I think it's fair to say that the Fraser's is very independent and has an independent voice. And I think you're looked on to provide that kind of ballast to received wisdom in the press, I guess.
Yeah, and it's something that we take very, we're very passionate about, is that kind of independence and partiality. Mm-hmm. And we'll not say things that everyone agrees with all the time. We'll not actually also not say things that are right all the time. And we're really open to having discussions with people about what we know, what we don't know, what we get right and what we don't get right. But I guess the key thing that we keep on saying is that as long as decisions can be based on evidence and fact, as best as possible, and also everyone could be honest about what we don't know, then as a society and as an economy, we'll end up in a better place. Yes, there's debates to be had about different policies and a whole host of different objectives that people have. But if we can make decisions trying to improve Scotland and make a better Scotland by the best we can do in terms of facts and evidence, then all the better.
So let me take you away from facts and evidence for a second and take you to the realm of imagination and feeling for a sec. When you first heard that we were going to land COP26 for Glasgow, what was your initial gut feeling and reaction to that?
I think that anything that brings an international focus to Scotland is brilliant, and it puts Scotland on the map. I think it's also a recognition of the journey that Scotland's been on over the last 20 years or so in the whole kind of energy transition space. It reflects the decades that Scotland's had around its leadership in oil and gas. So I think that all that stuff, I think when you hear an announcement like that, you think, you know, it's fantastic. A bit of selfishness comes into me going, goodness sake, what's Glasgow going to be like for when it arrives? And someone who has to kind of move around Glasgow on a daily basis, mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot of practical challenges. But I think it's a great opportunity to be part of a global, a really important global debate. And I think the timing of it couldn't be any more important.
Good. I'm going to bring Luca. I'm going to bring you into the conversation with that same question, actually, because you're very much involved in looking at whole the whole subject of energy policy and transition and so on. So, how did you feel when you heard that COP26 was coming to Scotland?
I was very happy. You know, I have to say that I was hoping we could get it to Aberdeen. Maybe that was an over ambition, but that would have been. Would have meant having the discussion about the transition in the heart of the oil and gas industry in the UK. And I think that would have been a fantastic opportunity, not without the risks and implications, but, you know, so, but Glasgow is close enough, I guess. And I think it's interesting to see that, you know, this is, of course, a UK hosting, not a Scotland hosting, if you want, but the fact that it is in Scotland gives us an opportunity. You know, an opportunity to present Scotland and present the oil and gas industry and to have a serious reflection, you know, and consideration of what the industry, oil and gas industry role is in the road to net zero. That's why I was hoping to have it in Aberdeen, but yeah, as I said, Glasgow is close enough. And so that was the first reaction. And then, you know, we know that it moved from November this year to November next year, you know, and okay, I'll be the first one to say COVID here, because at some point we'll have to talk about that as well. And one, you know, before you ask, I guess that on one hand, it was a bit of a frustration for postponing 1 year, just like we are postponing a number of things because of this pandemic, of course. But at the same time, it's maybe an opportunity. And I think that's what we're trying to do here is, you know, there's an opportunity to do more and to come to Glasgow more prepared as an industry and as a nation, I think.
That's a good insight there, Luca. So just building on that, Graham, I'm really keen to hear what you think. Are we on the right track as an economy? Will we be ready for COP26 and in terms of having a good story to tell about the environment?
So I think with all of these things, there's strength and weaknesses in, I think, the story that we can tell. Obviously, you know, we have an economy that is, if you look at the Scottish economy in the UK and the European context, is actually relatively prosperous, relatively well off. And a large part of that is the role that the energy sector has played in creating wealth and opportunity for people over a number of decades. Mm-hmm. And you only have to look at the numbers, what we call the GVA numbers, growth value added numbers, for different regions across the UK. And you see the Northeast punching way above its weight in terms of its economic contribution, which in turn helps Scotland more broadly. And actually, if you look at the detail, if you actually look at the sector, the energy sector, particularly oil and gas, it is our one sector that is truly international. It's innovative, it's entrepreneurial, pays high wages. So there's a really important sector in there that has created economic prosperity over a large number of years. So there's a really important positive story to tell about Scotland's contribution in the energy space, you know, where we are now. The key is what happens next and how you transition through that. And we've spoken in the past about a window of opportunity for the Northeast, for oil and gas, for Scotland and the UK. Mm-hmm. But if you get it right and we can support that transition and continue to support the success for the oil and gas industry that we know we need to still have, even in a net zero world, then there's a real chance that success that's happened in the Scottish economy because of the energy sector over the last 40, 50 years, that can continue into the future. There's a risk, though, that if you get it wrong and you're on the wrong side of that adjustment, then actually a lot of the gains and a lot of the achievements could be lost. Mm-hmm. And again, if you look back again from a purely selfish Scottish perspective, the comparative advantage that we had with oil and gas was geography. And there was basically no one else who could compete with that for the very simple reason that it was in coastal waters close to Scotland. Yes, we still have a comparative advantage in other forms of energy, but it's not as great as it would be in oil and gas. So it's how can we use their expertise that we've got already to transition and make sure that we can retain that comparative advantage going forward. So I think in that part of it, I think there's lots of success, but there are some big challenges coming down the line. I do think one other point I would say where there's positives, but also negatives. You look at the broader transition to getting ready for COP. We've had some extraordinary successes in things like renewable generation over the last 10 years or so. But if you were to pose a question, well, have we really gained the economic advantages that we may have hoped to get from that transition in terms of the jobs, in terms of the investment? And I think there is. If we're being honest, we have to look and say, well, we probably haven't got the scale of that investment and the scale of the jobs that we would have potentially hoped. So one of the reflections, I think, going forward, if we're really to transition to a net zero economy, is how can we ensure that we gain the economic advantages and opportunities that come from that?
So that's a really interesting point. I mean, have you given any thought as to how to answer that question and how we can actually tackle that?
So I think there's a few things in all of that. I mean, I think the very broad answer to that is that I think that we need to see, and this is very much an economist talking, yep, but we need to see the transition to net zero as being about an economic threat, but also an economic opportunity, and actually thinking about how we can use the decisions that we take to create the jobs, to create the investment, to create the opportunities. So we don't just see it as being, of course, it's an environmental issue, of course, it's about climate change, but actually the solution to that is thinking about, well, what's the economics underlying this, and how can we think about our future investments, how can we think about our future skills, future planning, roles of universities, the entire system, to think about the transition to net zero, and not just it being, well, that's something which is an environmental issue that we should think about regulating or doing something about. This is actually an economic problem that you can turn into an economic opportunity.
So it sounds like an entirely systemic solution is required, rather than single point, let's just, you know, build more wind turbines. We need to look at the whole system of how we produce and consume energy in the UK and in Scotland in particular.
Exactly, yeah. And the idea was that we've built an economy over the last 150 years based entirely on carbon. So if you're going to turn around and say in the next 30 years you're going to essentially remove carbon in a significant way and go to net zero, that's not just something that you can do as a side issue. That basically needs a fundamental transformation of your economic model, yeah, fundamental change in behaviours, in investments, across all sectors of your economy. So not just about saying, well, let's build, as you say, build more wind turbines to create electricity. Actually about, well, what do we do about heat? What do we do about transport? What do we do about infrastructure, consumer behaviours, supply chains? All those things have to be the solution. And that requires a fundamental transformation in our economy.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, I know you've been doing a lot of work in this space, looking at various technologies that could make a difference to the energy mix in Scotland. How do you respond to Graham's point there?
No, I agree. It's a great point that we need to look at that as an economic opportunity, or focus on the economic development, not only, although it is very important, not only on the emission reduction and the climate change perspective. And you know, you mentioned, Graham, the advantages, and I agree with you. You know, the UK and Scotland in particular have some natural advantages. You know, there's a lot of wind. There's a lot, compared to the rest of Europe, there's a lot of wind on the coast, and even more now that we're moving to floating wind, so we can go farther and farther away from shore and catch the more stable and strong wind. We have a storage location for carbon capture. You know, natural storage location that can both in the depleted reservoir and in the aquifer, that can provide that storage for direct removal from the atmosphere or from capturing CO2 from industrial emissions, and that is a natural advantage. But as you said, other countries around the North Sea have similar advantages, and actually they're probably, I would argue, maybe acting already, and the race is on, you know. So it's not a given. Sometimes we tend to assume that because we got this natural advantage, it will come. I think there's a need for active intervention, incentivization, policies to start with, and technology to proceed with. You know, so we as a technology center, we focus on innovation, and sometimes you hear that the technology for hydrogen production, for wind, for renewables, and etc., is there, and we argue, yeah, it is there, but maybe it's not at the price point or the efficiency point that we need it to be. So we need to act on both sides. But we need to focus on the job opportunities, on the economy opportunity, because I'd like to hear what you think about that. You know, if you look at the wind, let's start with wind. You know, we have about 10 gigawatts installed at the moment in the UK. The plan from the CCC is the goal, you know, from the sector deal is also to get to 75 gigawatt plus by 2050. And we don't have a manufacturing industry. So should we think about it? Or have we missed the boat because there are already much more efficiency and there's a market where the big manufacturer have scale and economy advantages. But, and I get that, but I wonder if, with a captive, let's call it captive, it's not really, but with a captive market of 65 gigawatt to install in the next 40 years, isn't that enough to focus on a local manufacturing? Or that's not where the economic development will come from?
So it's a great question. And I think that one of the challenges I think that we face is the point I made about, you know, what are the industry, what are the job opportunities that come from this? And we hear all the time from policymakers about the green revolution and the number of jobs that are going to be created, and in the end they turn out nothing like that. Whereas, and that's completely different from the history of the North Sea, which was essentially about, well, an entire industry built from nothing that didn't exist anywhere else in the world to a significant extent, and the Northeast led that. But the point you're raising is quite right, that actually the rush to renewables, the focus on renewables, is now, it's a much more competitive market there. And it's easy to say, yes, we should manufacture, you know, kit in a significant way in the UK or in Scotland, but unless you have a manufacturing base, that's very difficult to do. So you actually need to build a manufacturing base in the first place before you can then start to think about upscaling that in a significant way. So I think there's some really big questions for industrial policy across the UK about actually how do you recreate a manufacturing base if that's what you want to do within all of that, and how do you do that at scale and relatively quickly? So it's easy to say you would like to have this, but actually the practical realities are much more difficult in that context. So I think there is a question there, but I think there's then also a much bigger question about actually where can you potentially use the advantages that we know we have in the UK and the Scottish context, particularly around innovation and particularly around research and development, and what can we potentially grow opportunities there to potentially lead the development of new technologies and new ideas. So it may be that the idea that we could build, have large manufacturing plants might be something that might be for another day or might be more difficult and tricky, but actually then, well, what could we do that generally supports the high level development of innovation, of research and development, of also the strong services sector that we have? What are the opportunities there to carve out niches in all of that? So sometimes, again, policymakers can make it quite simplistic, which is people criticize the government for saying, well, we're not building these turbines. Well, actually, that might be true, but that's not the, you know, just having a big manufacturing plant to build turbines is only a fraction of the prize that potential exists out there for this transition.
Yeah, I'm sensing a little bit of a, I don't really think frustration is the right word, but I'm sensing something there, Graham, that, you know, the opportunity is huge, that, you know, perhaps we need to do something differently to what we've been doing before in terms of policy and so on. So here's my question. Given the fact that we're coming out of the EU, and ostensibly we might not be bound by the state aid legislation or state aid rules, is this an opportunity for us to totally retool our economy and build that manufacturing capability, at least by having some sort of policy measure where we say, like, if you're going to supply this offshore energy business, you're going to have some level of local content in your supply chain?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, there's a few things in that. So I think if you're wanting to build a manufacturing base again, then I think it has to be an entire industrial strategy from all aspects of policy. So, you know, state aid and regulations are one of them, but it needs to be about skills, it needs to be about the role of universities, further education, it needs to be about a whole investment structure. You have to look at taxation, you need to think about how you can do support to rebuild that manufacturing base. And that's not easy. I mean, it's not easy to rebuild an entire sector in that context in a relatively short period of time, but it could be done. I mean, it could be, there's nothing to say that with significant public policy support, with the right leadership, that you could not redo it. And history has shown with oil and gas that you can do it if you do it at scale. I think one reflection in that would be is you really need to go for it. I mean, this can't be about messing around the edges and doing small scale adjustments. This has to be an extraordinary investment like it was back in the 60s and 70s around oil and gas. This really needs to be something that the UK, and it probably just has to be a UK wide again on that scale, but with Scotland playing a key leading role about really making a major investment and significant investment in all of that. On the specific point about state aid, yes, again, you could start to think about how you could potentially use that more creatively in a world of outside the EU and what you could do around that. Again, there's risks with that in the sense that state aid is an annoyance for many people, but it's also there for a very good reason, which is to stop government giving money to and trying to pick winners and trying to influence and shape the market in an unfair way. And state aid is there as a protection. It might be frustrating at times, but the principle of it has value. And also as well, if you're looking to think about doing future trade deals, not least with the EU, but with other countries as well, then obviously one thing that the opposing side in your negotiations will look at will be as well, what are the potential unfair advantages that UK companies are gaining in all of this? So it's not to say that there's definitely not a lot of opportunity to look at state aid differently, but it's also just to, you know, it's sometimes it will have some consequences too.
So you've alluded to, and I think that's very important when it comes to looking at the opportunity being a lot about export. Right? So, you know, again, the natural advantage of Scotland in terms of wind or other natural resources, but also the skills and the IP and the capabilities are much more relevant when, as you said, punching above the weight by exporting that to the rest of the world. So building that advantage or building on that advantage is as good as we are able to export, which requires some compromise with state aid.
Part of it as well is how do you do international partnerships where you can generally bring the expertise we have in Scotland and the UK with the expertise that exists internationally? And again, I think it has to be an entirely consistent and broad approach at scale, which is significant domestic investment, but also thinking about where do you make your international partnerships and international opportunities. And again, oil and gas is there's so much to learn from that sector about what it did, about what it did wrong as well, but also what it did right and how it was used to drive that energy revolution all those years ago.
I think you mentioned a very good point before, which is, you know, we built an oil and gas industry from scratch. Now, this is a transition is different because, you know, while we are building a green economy, you know, it's not from scratch. On one side, it is the advantage of maybe leveraging the oil and gas industry and its infrastructure, skills, capability, its ecosystem of innovation as well and academic research. On the other hand, is also the timing of necessary declining oil and gas industry, both from natural resources availability and from a climate demand. And I wonder sometimes that we are maybe, and I am an optimist, you know, but I wonder sometimes if we are over-optimist about the transition, because when we look at the jobs in the oil and gas industry and the labor intensity of offshore operation compared to the labor intensity of a renewable operation, there's a big gap. And, you know, so it's a bit naive, I think, thinking that we can just take all the oil and gas industry workers and move it to renewables almost overnight and the problem is solved. First of all, it will not be overnight. You know, it's a transition, not a switch. So it will take time and a lot of people will still be working in oil and gas for many years. But at the same time, some reflection needs to be made. Where are the jobs? Where are the development the economic development? Is it in carbon capture? Is it in hydrogen? It is in wind? It is in refitting gas boilers in housing to change the heat? So it's a bit more complex and nuanced than the jobs of oil and gas will go to renewable. Now, sometimes we hear as a simple solution. And we know it's not that simple, I guess.
It's a good point, Luca. And one of the things that just to draw on that though is, you know, the offshore intensity of employment offshore in oil and gas, as you've rightly said, won't be the same, isn't the same in the renewable sector. However, my question is, should we not expect to see, you know, jobs that are high value jobs, you know, high paying, lots of technology content, whole new technology substructure emerging from where we are now to support a more integrated energy system? Because we're going to have everything. We're going to have, I reckon we're going to have hydrogen, electricity. We're going to have all sorts of activities that are, you know, starting to come together to coalesce using existing infrastructure, resources and skills. So that would be my observation and question. Are we going to see the emergence of a completely new sector reshaped that has a completely different look and feel to the renewable sector and also the oil and gas sector?
Is that for me or for Graham?
I'm interested to hear both of your opinions.
Maybe I start and give Graham time to think. I hope so. And I really hope that the new emerging energy sector will be much more integrated than it is now. You know, what we see now is very siloed. There's an oil and gas industry, and there's an offshore wind renewable industry, or wind industry, if you want, or renewables. And then we have a carbon capture discussion, which includes some oil and gas, but it is more specialist at the moment. And hydrogen, you know, again, they're both hydrogen and carbon capture are very nascent in their infancy, but they're sometimes seen as a silos. And if you look at all the reports out there and all the research, they tend to look at the jobs created by carbon capture. And then you have a report about the jobs created by hydrogen. And you wonder, are these the same? Because when you talk about blue hydrogen, of course, you include carbon capture. And I hope that, you know, instead of this against that, you know, or oil and gas versus renewable, we'll have a kind of an integrated energy sector, which together achieve net zero. And we still have oil and gas for a while. But, you know, we need to have a cleaner oil and gas in the sense of not producing emission in production. And we need to have some of that oil as a feedstock for advanced materials that actually go back into the infrastructure which is needed for the renewable infrastructure. So I would like to see this morphing rather than transitioning, if you want to use a different expression, you know, in something which is a total net zero, good for the environment, good for the economy, but integrated energy system, as opposed to a siloed and discussion about transition from one to the other one.
And I think that's a very important point. And I think that one of the mistakes that we make, I think, when we think about the energy and we also think about the policy response to it, is we fall into the economics trap of thinking of sectors. And sectors are just designed simply by economic statisticians to make compiling economic statistics easy. So you just you just create boxes and you just put things into boxes. So then we get into the habit of talking about the oil and gas sector or the renewable sector or the energy sector. And actually what you're talking about, Luca and Stephen, is actually that, yes, there'll be certain activities that are designed around oil and gas, but actually what we're talking about is an entire system that operates right across the economy. So it's a bit like the digital system. The economy of the future will be driven by digital. You know, go back 10 years, we had a digital sector, but actually no one thinks about the digital sector anymore. We're all using digital. It's just it's just a thing that underpins our economy. And that's back to the point that I was making around, for 150, 175 years, our economy has been driven by carbon at a significant scale. And it's about how do we transition this to a world where we're not using it. And that is not about oil and gas just being replaced by renewables. That is about an entire system-wide change across the entire economy from every sector and every household and transport and heat and everything we do is got to be driven by new technologies, new ideas, of which Scotland's strength in this built over decades gives us a first move at advantage, which if we take advantage of it, then there are significant opportunities there.
So do you think we will take advantage of it, Graham? Are you optimistic about that?
I think as an economist, then...
Are economists
certainly
ever
wander
optimistic?
Around. So I think I am in many ways. I think that that there is significant potential there, and I think that it's easy to be critical of policymakers and say you're not doing enough. But if you actually look back over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a significant journey on the road to actually understanding and realizing, you know, the opportunities and the risks and what we need to do. I think we're at a really crucial point, I would say, over the next 5 years about actually turning this ambition and understanding into real delivery. And I think COVID-19 just makes that challenge even more difficult in many ways, but also more important. And I think the importance of actually turning this now into saying, we all agree about the need to for this transition. We all agree about the opportunities there. Now we need to spend all our efforts on thinking about how we do it, how we support it, what radical changes do we need to make happen, and move on away from strategies and high-level thinking into actual practical measures and be willing to take risks too.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that we've observed being a technology projects-focused organization, is that there's loads of thinking and strategy work that gets done, but what we try to do is really focus on the practical project implementation of technology in the field, and to stimulate that R&D work within the sort of, I guess, the academic base that we have in Scotland and the UK as well, to help with that.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the point that we keep on making in a number of different areas. And I think the energy transition is probably the most obvious in that regard. I mean, you could probably get every policymaker into a room, every business leader, every think tank, and okay, there are disagreements around the edges, but I think pretty much everybody knows what we need to do, knows the urgency, knows the scale of the challenge. It then becomes, well, actually, how do we go about doing it? So again, we've heard a lot in recent months around the Build Back Better and the importance of green investment driving that. And I don't think anyone would disagree that if we're going to invest and support our economy in the next few years, that a priority has to be, in inverted commas, green investment. But what? And how and where and at what time scales are we working to? And none of that's easy, and it's not to be critical of policymakers and in many ways, because it is difficult, but we need practical ideas and solutions. And also I think we need to realise that this isn't in the gift of policymakers. Quite a lot of the time when we talk about things, we say it's, and policymakers will say, we're going to do this and we'll drive this. Well, actually it's about the wider business community and all of us in households about driving that agenda and driving that change.
So you're suggesting all this debate is the change even top down or bottom up? So do we count more on the individual behaviors and change of mind, or if you want, of thinking, or do we need the policies and government to drive that behavior?
So I think it has to be both, doesn't it? So it has to be changes to individual behaviours at an individual level, at a household level, at a firm level, but also it needs major shift across at a really high level about this is the type of economy that we want to build and we need to build. And yes, that's policy, but it's also a significant role for business as well to think about its strategies, their opportunities, their long-term plans for how they will deliver on this transition too.
I think in discussion with businesses, though, the challenge is often, investments in the transition, investment in hydrogen or carbon capture, to make two good examples, are very big and over many years. And you need to have some certainty of policy or some certainty of the framework to be able to do that. And just making the example of carbon capture, you know, with the CCC saying that it is not an option. It is something we have to do, at least in the midterm, both for blue hydrogen, but also to decarbonize the industrial clusters. Then the question becomes, who does it? You know, there are companies that are maybe have the skills and the capability and the technology to be able to do it, but you need to make a profit.
It's a business model. You know, somebody's going to have to find a way of making money doing this for it to be, you know, to really kick off.
And if someone makes money, someone is paying for that money. So there's either a customer or a taxpayer or the consumer in the end that does that. And that's the big debate that somehow has been hanging on for a couple of years now, at least, and discussion is still up there.
Yeah, and I guess that gets to the heart of the discussion we've had already about the importance of, it's a system-wide response to this. So business models need to be designed, and then decisions have to be taken about, is this, you know, government-supported, taxpayer-supported, or coming through the consumer? But it also gets to the heart of, I think, of, you know, things like, you know, how does our, you know, what are the role of universities, for example, in supporting this transition? And what do we see as being valuable in that context? And again, it's rethinking their role in all of this. And you asked Stephen about where successes and where and challenges and where things have gone well and optimism and things like that. But I think there's an untapped significant potential in thinking about how you can use the wider research and development innovative community within Scotland in a truly productive way that can help support this transition. Because if we're being honest, it's pretty patchy historically. Yes. About how we've actually genuinely supported that the research and the practical measures in all of this. You know, you think you've got an economy that is genuinely, and the Northeast is genuinely the energy capital of Europe, you would expect to see enormous research and development and innovation centres, you know, coming at arms, you know, growing out your ears all over the place across the Scottish economy in that. Yeah. And it's quite interesting that we don't have that. We've got pockets of success, of course we do, but on a scale that doesn't match the scale of the industry that we have.
I think that's a great, I mean, it's an observation that's been made many times, isn't it? I mean, why hasn't the Northeast capitalized on the research opportunities that no doubt would have emerged over the last 40 years? I think one of the things we've learned is that a lot of research is, a tremendous amount of research is getting done throughout the UK. And you're right, there are pockets of excellence all up and down the country. But a lot of research gets done overseas as well. And depending on your capability and also your standing as a university, you're able to attract research fundings. I don't want to get into individual university performance. I don't think that's the right thing for us to do here, but I can sense a real level of frustration with the approach. So I'm wondering, you've obviously thought about this long and hard. Is there a solution to the problem, or even the prototype of an idea of a solution?
So I think that gets into a much wider question for me about what's the role of your university and also further education system within an economy. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just linked to energy, but I think more broadly, in that historically, and now this is a bit of a caricature and it's not entirely accurate, but historically the view of universities has been essentially as graduate factories where we teach people to get a qualification. That qualification equals a skill, they get a job, and that's them set for life. And that's been turned on its head by automation and the changing nature of our labour market. And then alongside that, you've got essentially an academic community that are awarded by research publications, which is essentially citations and being able to publish in high quality journals and books and things like that. But the role of impact has always been much less. Now that's changing in the UK with a drive towards a greater realization of impact. But I generally don't think that we're there at a level that I think needs to be for the modern economy in that context. So to do that, I think you have to start to reimagine entirely the role of universities within your economy and as your drivers of economic development. So yes, it's about skills and training, but it's also about what is the genuine economic value they create. So on a something like the transition to net zero, for me, the big ask to universities has to be is you have to help us get there. And we would expect to value and reward and shift government funding to research and development that is prioritised about tackling this major economic transition and energy transition that we need to face. Now, that's difficult, and it means a completely different view of universities. It probably means much greater direction for universities than we've potentially had in the past. But I think that if we have to genuinely see, well, what has Scotland got as a key strength? Energy sector, innovation around all of that. What also have we got? Well, we've also got an excellent higher and further education sector. If we're being honest, do the two work in harmony to give us the maximum impact for the world-beating expertise we have in both areas? I don't think if you put the two together, we do, apart from pockets of excellence in there. And there, I think, is a real opportunity that if you could pull together that wider research, that wide innovation, not just government, but actually genuine business. So how do you ensure incentive mechanisms for academics that working with business is just as valuable as publishing your latest paper in a journal article? How do you maybe match funding? So if you can secure business investment, that's where government investment flows for research and development. How do you basically reward innovation, not just research? So how do you actually focus on the D of R&D in universities and not just doing great research? You can come up with the best idea, but if you can't implement it, how, you know, so things like the catapults, things like, you know, your own centre, how can you actually genuinely reward engagement with that just as much as you'd reward, or even more so, traditional academic outputs or traditional teaching outputs? And there, I think you then got a genuine opportunity to help support that transition in Scotland and then to create the jobs and the value added in the future that might be lost from oil and gas.
Have you looked at the American model, the DARPA and the ARPA setups that they've got there? Because that seems to drive a lot of directed innovation in specific sectors.
Yeah, very much so. And I think and part of it as well is about thinking about the skills that we need in the medium to long term as well. So in the past, politicians, we've always thought about let's pick winners and let's pick sectors. But actually, if you look at a lot of the really successful economies around the world, what they do is they create the underlying skills base, which then creates the opportunity to take advantage of any sector and any innovation that goes in the future, because you're driving it. Not only are you driving it, but you're also able to pick up new developments and then run with it in your own local context. So I think that that's the sort of thing that I think starts to get into real opportunities to rethink the role of government. So back to your point, look, it's not just about government spending money on traditional things. It's about setting that strategic leadership across the entire economy that actually, if this is going to work, this isn't just about government giving subsidies for people to invest in new technology or to set up new kit. This has to be a transformation in the way that we think about the entire structure of our economy.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Creating a market, basically. And that takes me to two thoughts, if you want. One is the financial markets, and the finance available, because moving from R to D in the research and development, which I think we are doing, there is that sense of direction over the past few years. But then there is also the element of, you turn that into a business, you create a startup, and then maybe an SME. At some point, the scale-up and the big thing happens by taking that IP and that company overseas to the United States or somewhere else. So Scotland and the UK is very good at creating new company, but keeping them making the next Google, Facebook, Amazon, seems to be a harder thing. And I wonder, is that a cultural element? Is that a finance availability? Is that a different type of market? Because you cannot take one element from another context and replicate without looking at the overall system. You know, that usually doesn't work. It creates unintended consequences. So do we need to think of that in a more holistic way and not just the innovation technology, but the finance behind it and creating market for that?
Exactly, yes. And I think that gets back to the point is that this has to be a system-wide view of everything. So you need to think about what's your market structure and your support mechanisms that will help support that investment over the medium to long term. And that's where government investment does genuinely have a significant role to play, whether that be through different types of lending mechanisms or equity stakes or support for research and development. Because you're right, one of the challenges we have, particularly in a Scottish context, is we don't have a problem starting up businesses, but we have a problem in turning these businesses into genuinely businesses of scale and growth. Now, again, the energy sector stands apart from the rest of the economy in that regard, because there's a lot more dynamism in there. But it's, again, what can we learn the lessons from the success of that sector in creating companies of scale and growth? And how can we potentially look at that in the next round to look for opportunities? And already we have the Scottish National Investment Bank, the Green Investment Bank, the British Business Bank. But where might policy leadership at a UK and a Scottish level go in the future to genuinely support these long-term investments in companies and growth? And part of that's difficult because you have to accept failure. And that's a difficult thing in a political context, because it's easy to point the finger at people and say, you tried this and it didn't work. I think the more we have of, I'd much rather see a lot more of things not working than what we have at the moment, because it means we're trying. And it means that we'll be finding things that will generally work, and there'll be more successes than there are failures. But I think there's a risk aversion in all of this, which is going to be a challenge in the transition.
So I'm conscious of time. We're coming up to the end of our time together. I'd like to bring us all back to the thought experiment of putting yourself into the future. Just over a year from now, we'll be in a very clement or inclement Glasgow in November, being inundated with maybe foreign visitors. We don't know. I don't know how much they can do over Zoom. I think they have to come here. There certainly will be protests. There certainly will be lots of noise and discussion, some argument. But if you throw yourself into that future space and you could bring one thing that to that COP that you know that would make a difference from a Scottish and a UK perspective, and put it on the table and say, look, guys, let's get behind this idea, what would it be?
So for me, I would come back to the one of the very first points I made, that what I think would be really useful to have would be a proper industrial plan, not a strategy, but an industrial plan for how the UK and Scotland will link up all the various elements of its public policy support, from regulation through to investment, patient capital, through to skills, through to education, through to support for sectors, through to plans for future trade, etc., that is all lined up in a coherent plan for this is how we will support the industrial revolution that we need to needs to happen in order for us to get to net zero. And that linking of the two, of the transition to net zero with a proper industrial plan that's got innovation and research and development, all of that right at its heart, I think would be brilliant to see, and clear on detail, and be clear, and also be honest, it will get things wrong, but that for me would be a major achievement.
That's great. I love that idea of a new industrial revolution. Luca, I'm going to pose the same question to you.
I would love to see a shift in the narrative and in the dialogue. And that thinking of an integrated system, which Graham mentioned as well, that I described before, which I think we all can agree on the problem, and we all can agree that the solution is a transition, and that transition needs to happen as fast as we can, and we all have to be very, very quickly. But so far, often the dialogue has not really been a dialogue, it's been a confrontation between positions and principal position. I would like to get rid of that and focusing on what we want, everybody wants, is stop emissions and actually get into the negative emissions. And how we do it, it doesn't have to be one answer that fits one particular position. It's an open dialogue with the technology innovation at the heart of it.
Okay, that's grand. So we've covered an enormous amount of ground. Some really interesting ideas have been explored. There's actually been quite a lot left on the table as well, that if we wanted to, we could come back and unearth and kick about and examine. But I just wanted to say thank you so much, Graham. It's been fascinating to hear your views on how we're progressing and what it's likely to look like for us as a country as we're approaching COP. I hope you've enjoyed the experience as well and the discussion. Thank you. It's an exciting time in our industry, so please take it all in, get involved. And if you have any questions, get in touch with us via our website at ogtc.com. You can also follow us on our social media channels, LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, for all the latest updates.